Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
You know, I don't think of a legacy of slavery. I think of myself as a slave. I think of all the African-American men who are in prison in this country. That imprisonment is not a legacy of slavery. It is, I'd like someone to really tell me why it's not present-day slavery and why it doesn't work the same way and why 50 years from now, if someone looks back, they will just see these as two different aspects of slavery. That is, a dominant group's attempt to exploit and control a minority group. It's not changed so much. It's not some sort of alchemical transformation. Slavery is real.
I do not know why these double entry account of time intrigues me and why I'm compelled to call attention to it, to both its personal and objective forms. The time in which the narrator moves and that in which his narrative takes place. It is a peculiar interwining of time's courses, which are ordained, moreover, to be bound up with yet a third, that is, with the time the reader will one day take for a receptive reading of what is told here, so that he will be dealing with a threefold ordering of time, his own, that of the chronicler, and that of history. The compelling words of German novelist, short story writer and social critic Thomas Mann from his iconic novel Dr. Faustus, published in 1947. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. How has the history of slavery impacted on American society today? And will race and identity always remain the dividing line in American political culture? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with one of the most distinctive voices in African-American literature, John Edgar Wideman, whose latest collection of short stories, American Histories, has just been published by Canongate, where John writes, "If suicide is a crime, shouldn't martyrdom be illegal too? Felony or misdemeanour? How many years for attempted martyrdom? Neither a life sentence nor capital punishment would have deterred Jesus. Terrorists not deterred either." So what is the history of America, and how does history affect our present and our future?
Good evening. If my people spoke to your people and I sent them to give a kind of preview of their man to your audience, I guess they'd say something like, hey, this guy's been writing for over half a century. I started out publishing stories in about 1967. And I've been doing it ever since. I've always had a day job. I was a university teacher, University of Pennsylvania, University of Wyoming, Massachusetts, all over the country, all over America. And I spent 3 great years at Oxford, a new college. So I had a chance to see the world and try to put that experience of travel and cosmopolitanism and point of view not American into my fiction.
Really well done, John, on American Histories. I have to say it's a very thought-provoking read, very moving in parts, very reflective in some stories. And if there's a lovely pace to the book, I really enjoyed it. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. What are the responsibilities as a writer today? You've been teaching writing for nearly, I think, 50 years. And I'm just wondering, what are the responsibilities that comes within that?
Well, I think if there are 30 writers in the world, you'd probably get 30 different answers, as you should. My sense, I only would speak for myself. I can tell you what I'd like other people to do, maybe, but what I do myself is to, number one, try to make it quite clear that writing is something that is entirely, that's demanding, entirely demanding, that if you do it well, it will require almost everything of you as an individual, your intelligence, your body, your memory, and that because it is so intense, it is worthwhile. And that's the notion that I would try to project, communicate to students, as well as to other writers, as well as to the audience. I think the question that you're asking is a very, very good one. What's the writer's responsibility? And I think it's a question that is so important, because inevitably, by what we write, what we choose to write about, choose the point of view to write it from, choose the characters, I think we are always, answering that question, answering the question about the importance of what we do by the choices that we make in subject matter, in tone, in language, et cetera, et cetera. So in other words, we can't help answering that question. And whether we intend to or not, we are. If we write only about men or only about women or only about Irish people, then we're saying something about what a writer should do.
You open the book with a note to the President of the United States, and you write, "These stories should speak for themselves. The note is a plea. Mr. President, please eradicate slavery." And then you go on to write, "Mr. President, that history tells us many lies as truths." Can you talk me through that? Because I can imagine, depending on what circumstances you're coming through, the reader's coming through in their own life, they will look at that in very different ways. And some will, that will really fire them up, and other people will be extremely glad that you've said that.
A book is a leap of imagination. Any story is a leap of imagination. You might even make the argument that any piece of writing is a leap of imagination. But after I had finished writing all the stories that are included in my last book, American Histories, I wanted to do something that would kind of let the reader share with me my feeling of, well, this stuff fits together. There's some way that all these individual pieces make a whole. And I wanted to give a little guidance and actually talk to myself about what ways all the stories are integrated, because they're all different kinds of stories. And so I wanted to form or compose in this note to the president, not only some framework for the stories, but to let the reader share why I had done what I had done and what some of the purposes were. So to write a letter to a president and not name the president puts the words of that story in a way into a timeless space, and for me that is the ironic place where all stories exist. But in this particular case, I wanted to get the reader used to the idea that the stories that they were going to read took place in various epochs, various times, various places in the so-called historical record. I also at the same time wanted to problematize that record, because as we all know, the lions usually write the history of the wars. And I wanted to make clear that I was attempting to say something about the biggest possible picture of time and of history, but I didn't want to do it by standing above events as if I had some sort of objective, privileged authority. I wanted to make it very clear from the beginning that hey, I was just writing into a kind of a void, and that within that void there were things called presidents and events and dates and lots of terrible events. And my reaction to them, my perspective to all of that great cavalcade of time is almost like a kid. What the hell has been going on? What does it all mean? And so the letter takes the form of both innocence and also pain. The pain of having events in my life that repeat some of the worst things that have happened in the so-called history of my country. And showing that any individual life and collective life are not separated by hard and fast lines. So writing a note to a president, particularly at this moment in time when many Americans are wonder if we have a president or if we just have a sort of mythological person who supposedly runs the country. I thought all that energy that I was trying to get into the stories and that sort of framework I was trying to set for the stories might be that much more acute because of the ever presence of a president who is so intrusive and so also invisible, useless.
I presume in writing and reimagining the likes of Nash Turner and John Brown, and also the African-American female poet Phyllis Wheatley, that has cemented your philosophy of history and where history is going and what the questions that we should be asking ourselves now of our history and what we should do with our history.
It was, of course, very invigorating and fun for me, simply fun. To go back and reconsider some classic historical figures, but also to do it with the freedom of a fiction writer, not a historian, not the history of ideas, not academic looks at these people. I tried to get inside their skin, share a moment with them, but of course, one way to do that, I did go back to the academics. I did go back to the biographers. And so I just found that process very liberating because I knew that, first of all, there's the homework that I had to do just to reacquaint myself with the actual facts and personalities in the lives of these famous Americans. But to re-educate myself about who they were. Then when that part of the process was still in progress, I could start to make new people of them. I could make them into the people I wanted to make them. So that was maybe one of the most difficult things in the book, to keep the integrity, or at least what I felt was the integrity of these, of a Frederick Douglass, of a John Brown, to maintain the integrity of their particular role in history or what they wanted to do in history, and my own imaginative wishes and hopes and distortions of what they could have done and what they might have done. And I think my formula was to tell the truth as far as I knew it. And if I diverge from the facts to make it fairly easy or practical for readers to check me, to do their own research. So my figures are historically recognizable in terms of the dates and the times, and but then there's the license to move them around, to have a Frederick Douglass speak to a Donald Trump if I wanted to have him have that conversation. And of course, the license for me to feel as writer that I could speak to them and they could speak to me. Then the excitement when I felt in the writing process that these conversations were actually taking place. It was transcendent at times, and I still remember quite vividly moments with John Brown, for instance, his the way he became radicalized, if you will, just a kid, a little boy in the American Midwest, great wilderness, not being exposed to TV or iPads or movies or radio and TV, but able at the same time to get a sense of history, a sense of the world in which he found himself, and to have the courage to form for himself a set of values, to make judgments about what he saw going on around him. How he did that in the particular time and place that he lived is mysterious to me, and I want to try to understand that, because he stands as such a distinct example or contrast to so many of us who are just overloaded with information and pictures and ideas and records, et cetera, who at the same time sort of flounder as if we don't have the responsibility finally to pull together all the stuff around us, all the words, and make some sense of them.
I found your story, Williamsburg Bridge, incredibly moving, John. And you raised some very uncomfortable questions in it about suicide and how we view it in society and how we understand it all. And I think you got the idea for that story based on a photograph, was it?
I ran into some images on the internet. I was thinking, this was part of my research for writing a story about Williamsburg Bridge. And frankly, I don't remember the actual sequence, where the idea of jumping off the bridge or someone sitting on the bridge contemplating jumping off. I don't remember whether that started the story or just the fact that I walked back and forth across that bridge for exercise, for fun, probably 3 or 4 times a week. So I don't know which came first, but somewhere along that way, as I gathered information about the bridge, when it was built, how long it was, how much steel in it, who were some of the people who were actually responsible for its building, how dangerous it was, et cetera, et cetera. As I gathered information, one question was, what about suicide? Any bridge, any high structure seems to trigger in people the desire to fly or not to fly, as you will. But I found a website, an actual website in which there were photographs of a young African-American man sitting on the edge of the bridge, who, according to the website's proprietor, had actually jumped from the bridge, committed suicide. And that, along with gathering statistics about how many people jumped and where they jumped from, that became a riff, if you will, or kind of a possibility within the story. And I think that my identification with that young man sitting on the edge of the bridge is what promoted the notion in me, or probably scared me, is a better way to say it, scared me into thinking of my story as one in which each time I go across the bridge, or anybody crosses the bridge, that there are same moments, at the exact same moment, people who are not going to return from the journey across the bridge for one reason or another. Reason may be that they choose to jump or whatever. But bridges per se, and the notion that you start at one edge and they somehow take you to another edge, that's a very pregnant idea and symbol to me. because it's the way we live all the time. It's the way we live when most of the time, when we're not, when we don't have the leisure or we don't have the mood to think about how precarious an individual life is, that an individual human life is just as precarious as the life of a butterfly or a roach. The forces outside are so large and imponderable. Anything can happen at any moment. And I think part of being human is trying to avoid that thought, avoid the notion of annihilation, instantaneous, et cetera, et cetera. But it's always there. That possibility is always there. And when one crosses a bridge, the idea is you're going to get to the other side. And my story, Williamsburg Bridge, is me dealing with the fact that maybe you don't always get to the other side, the other end of the bridge, and why and how.
You also touch on, or one of the other stories in the collection, The Dead, touches on some of the challenges that you faced within your family, and you talk about your brother Otis, who kind of almost went into exile from the family and separated himself. And I'm just wondering, when you're writing something like that, looking at your own family experiences and the challenges, it's so deeply personal, and you're throwing that out to the world. I'm just wondering, what are the constraints, or do you feel any constraints when you're writing something like that? Because it's about your family.
Well, I consider Frederick Douglass and Phyllis Wheatley part of my family, and I feel that there's a level of intimacy and a level of sharing that that connects me with them as intimately and as significantly as I'm connected to members of my family. I think we're all in this together, and I'd like to, in my writing, to share that feeling that I have. It's a fact about imagination. One either believes in it or not. And if you truly believe in imagination, then the transition that's possible between one consciousness and another, one time or space and another, there are ways to transcend those spaces, or at least imagine transcending them. And so the writing of the history of some historical personage, or the history of my brother, the life story, the biography of my brother, are not all that different if you take either project very seriously. I wouldn't want to abuse the confidence or the integrity of a Frederick Douglass any more or less than my own brother. And the more I write, the more arbitrary certain kinds of distinctions are. The distinctions between men and women, black and white, even though it's being drummed into me all the time that maybe those are the only distinctions that matter. I think that's a kind of an illness. That's a kind of a cultural malaise, or maybe a fatal flaw in a culture, that difference is something that scares us, and we want to either pretend it's not there or work around it in ways that are destructive to what we're trying to conceive of, and destructive to ourselves. So how do we connect, and why do we connect? For me, that larger question kind of puts into abeyance and makes a story about family or a story about ancient personages kind of the same. Is that an excuse, or is that a rationalization? I don't think so. As a writer, I'm quite clear that writing about my sister or my cousin or my aunt May, if those people are alive and if they can pick up the book and what I've written or a story I've written and read it, it could hurt them. And I'm very much aware of that, very much aware. And when I, if I write about someone who's very fat and give it to, and there's a name for that person in the story, all the qualities or all the eccentricities might fit one name that actually exists in the family. But I'd make it very, I'd make that detail of gross fatness, never attach it to a character or a person in my family who's obese. I would change it. I would change the name. So there are always sort of, if you will, kind of wild card substitutions, so that somebody can't, either a person in my family or the person I'm writing about, can't exactly pin down a character in my story and someone else who's actually alive. When I'm writing about my sister and I'm talking about her kids and anybody who knows our family can identify what's there, I feel no responsibility in that case except to be as accurate as I can and tell the truth. If there's a detail that's possibly destructive or gratuitous that might hurt someone's feelings, then I try to avoid it.
So what you're saying there is whether it's you're looking at iconic figures in history or whether it's your brother or your son or your broader family, that you're within those stories or within those portraits that you're tackling universal truths and trying to tease out the questions within them. Is that it?
Well, that's partly it, but you... Ireland is a culture in which storytelling is, if I understand James Joyce, for instance, is a culture like mine that's very oral and where storytelling is very important, and storytelling in family events, funerals, weddings, wakes, are crucial in passing on to the younger people and preserving for the older generations the reality, the values of the family and the saga, the self-image or the collective image, how family exists and struggle and et cetera, all that passed on by word of mouth, by stories. So when we are sitting around in Homewood or you're sitting around in Dublin or wherever and the family's together and you're all talking, being accurate is one value. But more than that is keeping people entertained, keeping them laughing, keeping them holding their attention, charming them, making magical things happen, making it possible really for the family to move through time and move through oppression and get beyond a death or look forward to the children of a marriage that just happened. And that sort of back and forth, and that sort of energy is what matters. And that's what I'm trying to achieve in my stories with the language of African-American people as they in families together with the classical traditional language that I've inherited from the English novel, the American novel.
What keeps you up at night, John, or what gets you up early in the morning? Because you touch on aspects related to that in the story, The Shape the World is In, and you talk about, you know, your own personal ruminations and, you know, you're sitting in the house and you're hearing all the strange sounds and you're wondering what's going on in the world and you're kind of going into that space of reflection. So I'm just wondering that I imagine, you know, in your writing life of the last 50 years that you have asked yourselves lots of deep questions of the world, but I imagine those questions have changed. And as you've progressed through life, you're asking yourself different questions, are you?
What I'd say about it, when I look at the big picture, when I try to make sense of all those years, is one thing I say is stop it. You can't. And if you think one thing today, you're going to think another thing tomorrow, you're going to think another thing 5 minutes from now. And so what I try to do is kind of be humble and look at the moment, wonder about the shirt that I saw my son wearing, or wonder about the helmet on the head of my granddaughter as she's learning how to ride a little baby scooter. And thinking about that protective helmet, or thinking about the color of a shirt, then that's what would allow me to go to sleep. If I wake up in the night thinking about my son or my granddaughter, and I'm very, very curious person, very, very curious. But most of the time, my curiosity leads me in directions that are scary, if not in the direction of tragedy, of jumping off a bridge or losing a child, lead me in the direction of dissatisfaction.
And what about the legacy of slavery, John? Because it's something that you do tackle quite creatively in the book. And in terms of, you know, how we look at the world today when we reflect on our political history. I'm just wondering, how does that sit with you?
I don't think of a legacy of slavery. I think of myself as a slave. I think of all the African-American men who are in prison in this country. That imprisonment is not a legacy of slavery. It is, I'd like someone to really tell me why it's not present-day slavery and why it doesn't work the same way, and why 50 years from now, if someone looks back, they will just see these as two different aspects of slavery. That is, a dominant group's attempt to exploit and control a minority group. It's not changed so much. It's not some sort of alchemical transformation. Slavery is real. Slavery exists right now. We have guards. We have bars. We have huge concrete compounds. Prisons act as a kind of threat. We have patrollers who are given the power and the authority and the weapons to keep the minority population in line, the way what were called paddy rollers in the old days of slavery used to ride around on horseback or walk around in patrols and make sure African-American people were where they should be, doing what they should do. Slavery exists. It's the desire for it to cease existing that drives me, and my anger and dissatisfaction and rage at the fact that it has not changed.
And do you think it's likely that it will change in terms of that, you know, that we're naturally evolving and progressing in a more positive and in a more meaningful direction, that we will understand that all men are equal, all men and all women are equal? Like, do you think, you know, that America will always be divided on race lines, that it's part of the kind of the, I suppose, cultural legacy, if you will?
When I think of slavery, I don't necessarily think only of America. And when I think of slavery, I don't think only in terms of the classic description that we all have experienced one way or another. I think cell phones and iPhones and iPads and information can be used to incarcerate people and lock people down and be used as tools of power to form a hierarchy among human beings, hierarchies that allow some few at the top to exert powerful control over the ones, over others, over the many at the bottom. I think what's incumbent upon us is to understand how each of us has, each individual has choices that incarcerate or free both the individual and the people around you. How do you treat your children? How do you treat your mother? How does the mother treat her kid? Yeah, these are questions of power. These are questions of freedom that slavery with a capital S is a metaphor or is one form of.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. We go out to dinner and discuss relativity, dark matter, climate change, the origins and inevitable demise of the life form we represented, our guilt collectively or individually, yay or nay, for circumstances in which we find ourselves. We go out to dinner and discuss Breaking Bad, the nationwide epidemic of crystal meth, rural versus urban poverty, the former Attorney General's height, the INS, the IRS, ISIS, bedbug sniffling dogs. We go out to dinner and discuss those missing, the incisive and profound words of African-American novelist, scholar and teacher John Edgar Wideman from Dark Matter, one of the stories featuring in his latest collection, American Histories, published by Canongate. I asked John about the art of writing short stories and how he goes about the editing and redrafting process and how long it all takes.
I think that's one of the, if you will, slow stories in the sense of composition. Because I wrote it many different times, and there are many, many versions of it. And I seem to have a grasp on it and seem to be finished, and I kind of put it away and then read it, and it turned out to be totally inadequate or it didn't go where I wanted it to go. And I think it's one of those stories that I continue to work on. But that doesn't mean that it's not finished. It doesn't mean that maybe it's one of the most successfully rendered from my point of view in the collection. I think the stories that keep me going, the stories that that make me feel I want to go back to them are sometimes the very best stories. And Dark Matter is one of those. It might be interesting. It's just by coincidence an event that helped me crystallize the story, that helped me put it together, or put it another way, gave me the courage to put it together, had to do with Ireland. It's located in Ireland. My friend's father died in Dublin. I think that's in the middle of the story, that event. And my friend lives downstairs in this apartment building where I live, two floors down. And I did go down to offer my condolences to him. And we had been at a restaurant a couple nights before, and we had been talking about fathers and talking about growing up and talking about storytelling and et cetera, et cetera. And that actual situation, going, finding my friend kind of frazzle-haired in the morning and kind of wondering what the hell I'm doing, knocking on his door, and then our exchanging a look, and the exchange was telepathic as much as it was about words. And his wife was standing there looking at the two of us, and we were mourning. We were mourning the place where we found ourselves, and we felt lonely, and we had a whole culture and a whole history. Both of us behind us were middle-aged men, more than middle-aged, and but that momentary, simple wordlessness in a hallway of in a skyscraper in an apartment building in New York City coalesced and opened a door, and I certainly would never forget it. And I was in Dublin. I was with his father, and his father reminded me of mine when we had talked in the restaurant. Now, how do you get all that moment? How do you frame it? Where is it? What does it have to do with going to dinner? The story tries to talk about that, and that makes it a complex story. But how all those elements fit together is a mystery. I wasn't sure how to do it when I wrote it, and I'm not sure now. But I know you need moments like that. You need moments when you're not just intellectualizing or comparing or analyzing or doing cross-cultural thought or talking to your friends in a conscious way. You need the unconscious. You need the luck. Or the worry about something you share to bring you together. And then the rest of the story seems easy. The rest of the story grows out of those kinds of intense exchanges.
That must have been very rewarding in a very unusual way for you, that the story carries you and the momentum within that emotion that it was able to carry you. Like, that must be a very privileged space to be in.
Oh, writing is a privileged state. For a moment, there is no world. And anybody's a fool to think they could make one, or certainly a double fool to think you could make one better than the one there is. But the one there is very scary and very unsatisfying and very unfinished. And in a sense, when one undertakes to write a story, you are trying to improve the world, or at least one that you think, you make one that you think is a little better than whatever else is on your mind. I don't see myself as I don't see writing as a mirror. I don't think I'm pulling a mirror along a road and taking the reader along with me, seeing what I see in the mirror or what the mirror sees. I think we're starting from zero, ground zero each time, or I think I'm starting from ground zero each time. And to have the optimism to do that, to have the privilege to do that, is certainly an extraordinary privilege. It's like waking up in the morning, and each time we do, we don't know what the hell's going to happen. But if we're at all conscious, I think there has to be a moment of exultation, a moment of, wow, look at this. There's a sky out there, or at least I think there's a sky out there. I have arms, legs, I'm starting to smell things, maybe myself, I'm starting to think things. Isn't this something? And that's the way stories, I think, work when I'm writing them well.
I didn't know much about Phyllis Wheatley, and I looked her up and on the internet, and was surprised that I hadn't come across her. But she seems like she was an extraordinary woman, an extraordinary poet, and an extraordinary human rights activist.
What's so interesting about her is that we don't know that much. No one knows very much about her. There are some there are more biographical details today than there were 30 years ago, but you can make up a Phyllis. Yeah, and I think just the few lines of hers that survive, the few lines, are enough to start the imagination working and to make a connection. So that's a great compliment to the few lines she has left. And it's also a compliment to the capacity of human beings to relate, because she's a very shadowy figure, just bare outlines of her life. But if we make an effort and think about the time in which she was writing, the place, we begin to construct a very elaborate and very intense historical context for her. And not only that, but for ourselves. She's a person in transition. She's an immigrant. She's someone battling with at least two different, very distinct languages, actually probably three or four, maybe a tribal language, maybe the African language of people who captured her, the accents of various Americans, the languages of other Europeans she might have come in contact with in the trade. It's so easy to begin to cross the years, to cross those time barriers and connect with her. And she left those poems as a kind of little light on the road, crumbs on the road that we can follow. And once we do, it's very, very rewarding.
So last question for you, John. What is the hope with the book? Because you've tackled so many uncomfortable issues in relation to identity, race, prejudice, issues in relation to dislocation within family life and separation, and also, you know, the trajectory of history and where it's going. So I'm just wondering what you want the reader to reflect upon and possibly what's the hope within it all?
I wrote the book because I needed to write the book. I wrote the book because the act of writing entertains me, because, as I said before, I'm very curious about life, but also life often disappoints me, so I need to go further. I need something other than the actual events that occur to fill up the space, the gaps that I experience. And so I would hope, if someone gets a chance, someone has an interest, and they pick up my book, American Histories, that it might do for them as readers what it does for me as a writer. Now, whether or not that happens, how many people read it, how many buy it, that's totally out of my hands, just like it's out of my hands to actually control or to make the meaning I want to attach to a story or to an event actually transpire, actually be communicated to my readers. So, hey, the book, if you will, is a flower or a weed that I hold up in my hand, kind of look at as closely as I can, and it means something to me. And I think about people who are like me and people who are unlike me and wonder, you know, if you were looking at this particular object, this growing thing that I have in my hand, whether the growing thing is a plant or my granddaughter or whatever, what would you think about it? What do we think about it? And isn't that something?
American writer, scholar and teacher John Edgar Wideman. American Histories is published by Canongate and retails for just under €15 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to close tonight's broadcast with the robust words of John Edgar Wideman from American Histories. This note is getting too long, and to be perfectly honest, Mr. President, I believe terminating slavery won't disappear until only two human beings left alive, neither one strong enough to enslave the other. Anyway, please read on and enjoy the stories that follow. No strings attached, no obligation to free a single slave of any colour, Mrs. or Mr. President. Powerful words indeed.
Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.